Good morning, church. It is such a blessing to be here today. Amen. I am so thankful for the leaders that we have, and for the role they have this morning on Sunday mornings, bringing us through worship and just reminding us of who we are before the throne of God, and just really powerful job done this morning. I just as a way of reminder, we have at the back of our auditorium, there are some index cards and ways for you to fill out, and you can just drop them in the contribution box back there if you want to do that, or if you want to give those cards to Joel or Jerry or Joel or Jerry, either one of them, or even you can give them to the elders. Just fold them in half so they can't see. And you can write down the names of anyone you want to be our elders going forward. And I don't know that our elders are so humble, and they've tried to remove themselves out of this process. But I'm going to tell you that they're all like 5 out of 10 stars elders. I mean, they are really... No, they're really good, and they are all excellent elders. And if you want them to continue being your elders, you need to write their names down. And if you didn't do that earlier and you're like, oh, well, I forgot, you can fill out more than one card. Don't turn in the same name multiple times. But if you didn't know and you would like to also submit David or Peter or Russ or all three, you can go back and write those down and submit those as well. And it has gone really, with the process seems to be going really well so far. We're going to have one more lesson this morning, and then you'll have another week to think about it. And if anybody you want to talk to about that, if you think you want, you know, Bob to be an elder, there's nobody here named Bob, is there? I don't think so. But fictional, where's Bob Husky? He's not here this morning. Yeah, we don't want Bob. He's not even here this morning. Sorry, Bob. What's that? Oh, that's true. Ooh, sorry. Man, that's why I shouldn't be an elder. All right, so anyway, but just a fictional character, Bob, not the real Bob Husky. A fictional character, and you think you might want this character, Bob, to be an elder, go to them and have a conversation with them. They might say, you know, I'm very honored, but that's not something I feel I can do at this time. Or they might say, let me think about it and pray about it and get back with you. But either way, have a conversation with them. And if they say they would be willing to consider it, write their name down, turn it in. Really good to have those conversations. All right. Christian author's name's J. Keith Miller. You may have seen some of his books or read some. But he wrote about this short talk. Their congregation had children's church. And their lead pastor, their preacher, was going to be giving the talk in children's church that morning. And it was going to be on the 23rd Psalm. So the lead pastor comes kind of rushing in last minute, and the kids are all sitting there. And he rushes up to the front, and he starts talking all about the sheep and how, you know, the sheep are not that smart, and they need lots of guidance. And that was the shepherd's job, to stay close to the sheep and to protect the sheep and keep the sheep from wandering off and doing dumb things that's going to get them hurt or even killed. And so he pointed to the children in the room as he's concluding his talk, and he said that you all are the sheep. You know, you need lots of guidance. And so the minister sort of put his hands out to the side and had palms up in a dramatic gesture, and he raised his eyebrows, and he said to the children, so if you're the sheep, who's the shepherd? And there was kind of silence for a few seconds. Then this young visiting child said, Jesus. Jesus is the shepherd, which, kids, is always the right answer. And so this kind of younger minister was a little bit caught by surprise, because he was obviously meaning himself, right? So he said, well, yeah, Jesus is the shepherd, but who am I then? So the little boy frowned for a second. I said, I guess that means you're a sheepdog. So this morning, we're continuing our study of the roles of elders or shepherds or sheepdogs, continuing our analogy. Shepherds or elders or bishops are the sorts of people who mirror the shepherding life of God and Jesus. They aren't the upfront shepherd like Jesus, but they mirror that shepherding life. They're the sorts of people who lead in the same manner as Jesus, who are the same sorts of shepherds that Jesus is. And choosing that and thinking about who we want to choose, it requires us to ask some really important questions of ourselves, all right? So I'm just going to give you some, it's not an exhaustive list, but I want to give you some questions to be thinking about. As you're thinking, who do you want your shepherds to be? Ask yourselves these questions. And the first question is, who do you want to shepherd you? In other words, who would you go to deepen your understanding of the gospel? They need to have a good grasp on what it means to lead a life following Jesus and a good grasp on the gospel and the doctrine that comes from it. Who do you want to apprentice you in the life of Jesus? So that's what we mean when we ask, who do you want to shepherd you? A second type of question you might ask is, who would you go to with life questions, right? Who would you go to mentor you in your marriage, if you're married? And you look at them and you think, I want to be a husband like he's a husband. Or I want our marriage to look like that marriage. Who would you go to for advice in raising children? And you feel like maybe they've done the sort of job parenting that you would like to do parenting your kids. Who would you go to for advice about friendships or work relationships or even your professional life, right? Not that they are the head of your profession, but you might go and say, you know, I've been struggling with a boss. How should I get on with this? And they would be the sort of people you would go to with questions like that. Thirdly, who would you like to represent us? And this is kind of tricky one because I don't think we think about this very much. But I think Paul makes it clear, who do you want to represent the congregation in the wider world, in the community? Who would you want to represent us at a public hearing? Right? If someone said, we need to get to the bottom of what's going on at the Forest Mill Church of Christ, who do you want to be there to answer those questions? If someone were to say, we don't really know what those folks are doing, we're going to do a news story on it on the radio or on local television, who do you want to be the person explaining who we are? Who's not going to be up there and look one way on TV or on the radio and look different in our community to where it's a little embarrassing, right? So in explaining the roles of these elders or shepherds to Timothy and Titus, the Apostle Paul described them in this way. And this is what he said from 1 Timothy chapter 3. He said, here is a trustworthy saying, whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. It's a noble task to be an overseer. Now, the overseer is to be above reproach. Now, I believe that that's where Paul sort of puts, and we don't get, by the way, we don't get grammar in the Greek or the Hebrew Bible, so we have to put that in English, but I think this is where Paul sort of takes a pause. In general, they need to be people who are above reproach, and then he explains what above reproach sort of looks like. And so he goes on, he continues on and says, this is what I think above reproach looks like. This is from the NIV, by the way. Faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him. And he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. Because if anyone doesn't know how to take care or manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert. Or, in other words, and this is, by the way, not a knock on recent converts, just Paul's noting the dangers that are inherent with a recent convert. Because if he's a recent convert, he may become conceited and fall into the same judgment as the devil, thinking too much of himself, right? He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. So Paul describes this role here in 1 Timothy. He also does so in the book of Titus, the first chapter, verses 5 through 9. And those lists, if you sort of stack them up side by side, there would be a lot of similarities, a lot of overlap in the discs, in the list there. So we're just going to kind of focus on 1 Timothy. If you'd like to also go and read Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, I would encourage you to do so. It's a similar sort of description. We're just going to focus on this one this morning so that we can hone in on a couple of things that I think might stick out to us or hang us up a little bit. And the first of those that we need to talk about probably has to do with marriage. Because we in churches of Christ are really unique in our understanding of what it says here. At least the way we've interpreted it. So in the NIV that I just read, they translate it as faithful to his wife, but you can find a number of different interpretations. The NRSV, I think, is husband of one wife, all sorts of different translations because, well, we'll get into that. Because in Greek, it's a really weird phrase. The reason you get all these different English translations of this phraseology is because it's not a known Hebrew phrase. Literally, the phrase is, you need to be a one-woman man. Just like the country song. That's right. And that phrase, it's not just unique in Paul's writings. It's unique in all of Scripture. In other words, we don't see this phrase anywhere else in Scripture. Not only that, we don't see this phrase, or at least we haven't found it, occurring anywhere else in any Greek literature. This is the only place in the world you're going to see this phrase. So that makes figuring out what it means really difficult. That's why you get all these different translations. What does one woman man mean? So how can we figure out what it means if this is the only one of them, right? Well, we can get a clue from 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 9, just a couple of chapters later. And in there, Paul is describing, they've got this issue here in Ephesus where they've got several widows who are not being taken care of. And Paul's like, y'all need to get some folks together and take care of those widows. Women who are not able to provide for themselves because their husbands have passed away, that sort of thing. And so he's describing the widows that the church needs to look after. And the ones they ought to be taken care of. And in describing these women, these widows, he calls them one-man women. These widows need to be one-man women. I told you there's no other place that says one-woman man. There's one place that says one-man woman. And those get really confusing going back and forth, right? But that sort of gives us a clue. So whatever one-man woman means for elders, it has to also sort of apply to these widows because they are one-man women. So if that's the case, it cannot mean just married to one person right now. That's not what one-woman man can mean, married to one person right now, which is the way we in churches of Christ have always interpreted it, which puts us unique not just right now, but in the history of the church. You go back all the way to the 3rd century, which is the earliest we have records from. They interpreted it as they can be married, but it's better if they're not because they're including the rest of Paul's writings. So most of the early overseers were single, like never married. And you go into the Eastern Orthodox, the branch that emerges out of this, they could be married, and they get really stressed, but they could be married but not be having relations with their spouse. In other words, you live in the same house, you live as a family, but you're not one in that way, right? That's the way they interpreted it. And this has been going on for over 1,000 years, like 1,500 years this has been going on. And then we came along about 200 years ago, and we're like, no. It has to mean they're married to one person right now. But based on what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 9, that doesn't seem to be the case. These widows are one-man women. It's just the flip phrase of this. So whatever it means for the elders, it also has to be consistent for these widows. It cannot mean married to one person right now, because these widows do not have a spouse right now. In fact, we know from the early roles of the church that some of the widows were never married. They were women who just never got married. And now they're reaching an age in life they can no longer care for themselves and make enough income to take care of themselves. And so they are brought in. Single women, virgin women who have never married, never had a husband, are included in the widow roles. So the early church, including even early in the churches of Christ, we never thought early on, until like the 1950s, that elders had to be married. We never thought that. Because, and this was some of the rationale, if that was true, that elders had to be married, then the Apostle Paul couldn't be an elder. And that doesn't make any sense. If elders had to be married, Jesus couldn't be an elder. With all of Jesus has the perfect character, but Jesus couldn't be an elder. Sorry, Jesus, you cannot lead us because you are not married and have kids, right? So for the history of the church, they never thought this applied to widowers or even single people. Would that be a help possibly in shepherding? Absolutely. But it doesn't necessitate that you have to be married. So I don't believe that it excludes people who are single or widowed. Biblically, elders, I think, could be singled or widowed. And conversely, some people read that and they're like, well, maybe this is talking about polygamy. Paul is, you know, putting out against them. And by the way, I think it applies to polygamy. If any of you are here are married to multiple people, we need to have a conversation. I think this applies to polygamy. I don't think that's what Paul is talking about. And the reason was, wasn't a lot of polygamy going on. For even in the Roman Empire, there were certain pockets where there was limited polygamy, not in Ephesus or anywhere Paul was writing to. It was not an issue where they were. It was so rare in the Roman world, Paul wouldn't have to address it. And by the way, it was unheard of in the Jewish world at this time. There were no Jewish polygamists by this point, no men with multiple wives by the time we get to this point in history. So there'd be no need for Paul to write a letter to Timothy and Titus. He says the same thing, that you just need to have just one wife. Don't need to have three or four wives. That's not what he seems to be talking about. But maybe it means, this is a third option, and there are others. These are kind of the three main options people think. Maybe it means married only once, which is the way some people, some translations will even interpret one woman man. And the idea for this interpretation goes back to, you're just getting history this morning. I'm so sorry, but this is pretty important for the life of the church. So I think it's important we understand it. It goes back to Greek virtue culture. In other words, in Greek culture, which was, you know, certainly part of the Roman Empire, they highly valued virtues. And one of the virtues was just to be married once. They highly esteemed women who married a man, and when he died, she never remarried. In fact, they had, there was a phrase in Latin that persisted for several hundred years. Univera. This woman is an univera. She only married one time. She only had one husband. They were highly valued, highly esteemed women. And the Jews, by the way, had a similar phrase for Jewish women. They picked up on that virtue. There was a Jewish phrase, a Hebrew phrase, to also describe this woman. Paul doesn't use either one of those phrases. Someone who was just married once. So I think if Paul meant to imply that, he sort of could have said that really, really easily. There was lots of language to describe it that way. But I don't think that's what he was trying to say. And I'll just say at this point, I don't have the magic bullet. I'm not like the one Greek scholar who gets this all right. I did a lot of study this week, and I found help in trying to understand this. But eliminating some of those other interpretations sort of leaves us with the most likely explanation. It means that someone who is married is faithful to their spouse. A one-woman man is a guy who doesn't sleep around on his wife. A one-man woman, for these widows, were women who were not going out and having affairs in the community. They were married to their husband died, they were faithful then, they're faithful now. They may get married again, and if their second husband dies, they can come back and be on the widow roll, right? They've been married more than once, but they can still come back and be on the widow roll because they were faithful spouses. And again, this is not my magic bullet answer, but this is what I believe Paul means. And if you have questions about that, I understand it's less traditional, but, and I'd be happy to have a conversation about it, and I'd be happy to give you resources if you want to study on your own. But anyway, so what does above reproach mean? Going back to the original meaning, it means that an elder or pastor or bishop or presbyter, whatever phrase you want to use for it, that they are a faithful spouse while they're married. And they don't, and it goes on to talk about, you know, people who don't fly off the handle when they don't get their way. I'm sure you know people who are the best men and women. I mean, they're just so much fun to be around until something goes wrong. And then it's Katie bar the door. Don't be pointing in here this morning. It is Katie bar the door when something goes wrong. And you better like, oh, do not talk to Bob again today. Our fictional character, Bob. Bob Husky's fine. But our fictional character, Bob, don't talk to him. You know, he's had a bad morning. Right? He'll be fine this afternoon. Just let him drink some coffee and stay away from him in the meantime. Right? They're not people who fly off the handle when they don't get their way. And they're not out there living lives that are like embarrassing their families. You know, they're not making comments that you're standing in public going, oh, cannot believe one of our shepherds or one of our members said that. Oh, I'm so embarrassed. Right? They can guard their tongues and say things that have great purpose. And if they're married and they have kids, what sort of parents are they? Remember, we're talking about, Paul is using the idea of city elders from the Old Testament. And city elders, we think of families being mother, father, you know, son and daughter, whatever, kids. Mom and dad and kids, the nuclear family, as we call it in our culture. But Paul's not thinking about family that way. Paul's thinking of family in the Jewish way, which is, you know, there's a grandparent up there somewhere that y'all, he may or may not be alive, and you got four or five or six families, and they're all together, and there's kids running around. And this person, in the context of that family, whether they are married and have kids of their own or not, how do they treat the rest of the family? How are they treating the children in that family? Because those kids were as much their responsibility as their physical kids. He's thinking about them in that broader context. So bringing that up to our day, I think it's really important given that we do have nuclear families. We don't have that bigger family context. I think it's important that we look at someone, if they have children, and see how do they raise their own specific children. But if they didn't, how are they with their family's children? How are they with kids at church? How are they with not only their spouse, how are they with other people? What sort of relationships do they have? Are they apt to teach? In other words, are they passing along their faith to the next generation? If something were to happen to you and you could no longer raise your kids, who would you ask to raise your children in the faith? That one ought to hit home. Who would I entrust with raising my children so that my kids will end up with the faith like I want to have? I think that's a good way of thinking about it. This is not going on through this. By the way, this is not an exhaustive list. It's not a comprehensive list. It's not a concrete list either, in the sense that, okay, well, this guy's married, guess he has to be an elder. This guy has kids, guess he has to be an elder. This guy is, he's pretty docile, guess he has to be an elder. It's not one of those sorts of lists where everyone is bang, bang, bang. It's not a checklist. In fact, that's why I think the list looks a little bit different in Titus, because Titus is ministering in a different context than where Timothy's ministering. This is not one of those sorts of checklists. Rather, this is about what sorts or what types of men should be elders. What kind of people should be elders? And there's not a cookie cutter checklist, because all of the people are coming from all sorts of different backgrounds. Some people didn't become Christians until they were 30, and they did a whole lot of heck raising when they were in their 20s. Some people have, over the course of their relationship with their spouse, become a lot better husbands or a lot better fathers, right? They didn't start off that way. One of the most godly men I know is my wife's grandfather. And I didn't meet him until he was nearly 80 when Rebecca and I got married. He was quite a bit older. But he acted really young. He was really funny. He would do all these goofy things. And just loved him. But he would talk very candidly. He did not grow up a Christian. And he became a Christian kind of early adulthood. But he would talk about what a terrible temper he had. And it was hard for me to even fathom this man that I knew having a terrible temper. And he would say, oh yeah. And I thought he was just being humble. And then talking to his kids and his wife, no, he had a terrible temper. But he had just grown so much spiritually, that was no longer who he was. So people can grow and change. This is not like, well, I knew when they had kids 30 years ago that they were a bad husband or a bad father, and so they can't be an elder. People can grow and change. This is not, again, a comprehensive list. And things happen in life. We were talking about this in the elders meeting this morning. But it's not comprehensive because, you know, you may know people like this who married someone and they were a great spouse and their spouse was great. And then all of a sudden, someone fell into addiction and became a not great husband or wife. Someone started struggling with mental health issues and became a not great husband or wife. And one person can be faithful and good and try, and you can't make up for what everybody else does, right? You can try, and yes, you're human. You're not going to be the perfect husband or wife. Those things happen. They happen as spouses. They happen as parents. I know people who are like the most godly parents. I would love for those people to raise my kids if something happened to me. And yet they have a grown child who's just gone off the deep end and just living this wild and crazy life. Does that mean that they were not godly parents? Absolutely not. God never makes those lock down, rock solid promises that if you'll just do what I tell you, everything will turn up roses for you in life. He makes those promises about the life that's to come. But he never removes someone's free will. In other words, if I do my very best to be a great husband, I think it increases the likelihood that my wife will be a good wife. But God's not going to remove her free will and say, well, she wants to steal all your money and run off to Panama, but since you're a good husband, I guess I won't let her do it. My wife would never make it all the way to Panama with my money. But anyway, you know, God still gives her free choice, and she can still make her own decisions. God never says, well, you were a good mother or father, and yes, some of your kids have grown up faithfully, but other ones, they want to go off and drink and party and live a wild lifestyle and become unbelievers. And so I guess I can't let them do that since you were a good husband or a good father or mother. No, your kids still have free will, and they may grow up to do that. That doesn't mean you're a bad mother or father. So here we are on the outside, and we're trying to make these judgments, and it's hard. I'm telling you, it's hard, because you never know. Someone could look to you like the perfect father or mother, like the perfect husband or wife, and yet behind closed doors with their family, they could be pretty bad. They could be neglectful or abusive and have language that harms their family and lifestyle that tears them down. They could do that, and we'd never know because we just see them on Sunday mornings, and boy, they just look great. It's hard to make that judgment. Conversely, you could see someone who's raised these kids, and their kids have gone off, and they're not believers anymore, and you're like, well, I guess that means they're not a good mother or father, and they could have sacrificed everything to bring those kids to Jesus. You just don't know because kids still have free will. So what Paul is giving us is not, again, one of those locked down, rock solid checklists. This is what sorts of people, what types of people. And looking at that, these biblical texts, it's clear that we need to be thinking about character and family and maturity and reputation and gospel sharing. Who's like telling the story of Jesus? Men who embody these sorts of characteristics rather than just the checklist. And nobody is going to do that perfectly. Nobody. I found these quotes from early in our movement. This one's from David Lipscomb. I'm just going to put this up and we'll be about done. This is what David Lipscomb said. He said, "The Holy Spirit has described the qualifications of elders in the first letter to Timothy, and in that to Titus. None are perfect in their character." So none will have in perfection these qualifications laid down. That is, all will possess them in a human way. Brothers and sisters, we know that mature leadership is necessary for God's church. That's why he brought these leaders in. And elders need to understand that the task they are undertaking, it is honorable, it is noble, it is praiseworthy, and it is worth the sacrifice they're making in the rest of their lives. And as a congregation, we need to honor and respect those who willingly serve in that capacity. So whether it's this morning or next Sunday morning, if there are men that you want to be our spiritual leaders going forward, I would strongly encourage you, take 2 minutes, write a name on one of those cards at the back, and bring it to one of our elders, or you can bring it to Joel, or you can bring it to Jerry Kreitz, and give them that card, or you can just drop it in the contribution box. You can even give it to me. I won't peek. And we'll just talk. All of those will be turned over to Joel and Jerry, and they'll be having conversations going forward. So if there's anything we can help you with this morning, if you are in need of a godly shepherd, of someone to walk along you spiritually in this life, to teach you to be the sort of man or woman you need to be, if we can help you at all, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?